All right, so we move into our one of the last Eightfold Path, and that's the wise mindfulness. So if you're just joining us, we're going through this systematic exploration of the Four Noble Truths, and we did the first four truths, and now the last one is Eightfold Path. So we just finished wise effort, and now we're moving into what's called wise mindfulness. And it's one of the ones we may be the most familiar with because of our meditative practice. We all practice mindfulness meditation. We kind of have a sense of what that is. But I hope to go a little bit more deeply into that and also start to see how it integrates to the rest of the Eightfold Path. Because it's a really critical path factor because it makes all the other ones come alive. Because if you're not paying attention, if you're not connected, how can you have wise speech? How can you have wise in view, wise intention? You really need that wise mindfulness to make it all work. There's a sutta that I might talk about at the end of the month around that integration. Now, this word mindfulness, mindful, is something that you're likely to hear almost every day, right? Just you hear an announcer saying, "Be mindful of that." You go to England and you go to the tube and they say, "Mind the gap," right? Mind the gap. So it's this word that has really kind of taken off and become very embedded in our society. It's, you know, seeped into our common language. Just a quick dictionary look at it. This is the quality or state of being conscious or aware of something. Their mindfulness of the wider cinematography tradition. And so it's a sense of being mindful, being aware of. And this is interesting, the power of this one word and how it's really integrating into our culture. And this is one of the things that Buddhism has done over the centuries, over the 2,600 years of its development, is that it started in India, but as it went to different countries and different cultures, different regions, it started to take on flavoring and shapes of those cultures. It started to morph to fit those. And at the same time, it also went the other direction, that those cultures were changed and affected by Buddhism itself. So it's this interesting shifting and co-creation that happens. And sometimes those cross-pollinations have some distortions built in. Sometimes they're more true to it. I haven't read this book, but this title is great, that Mick Mindfulness. How mindfulness became the new capitalist spirituality by Ronald Purser. So if you read that book, tell me if it's any good. But it kind of points to that, how our culture tends to commercialize things, even something like spirituality. You know, you can learn how to be a more mindful stock trader, probably. There's probably a book on that. You know, we can find all kinds of ways to be more mindful, but it's kind of serving this capitalist viewpoint. But yet, it still maintains some of its essence, this word mindfulness. Like, be mindful, we pay attention. We open up to what's here right now. So tonight, I'd like to go back to some of the deeper roots of mindfulness and where this word comes from and how it's really a core aspect of the Dharma practice. The key sutta around this practice of mindfulness is called the Satipatthana Sutta, or sometimes called the Foundations of Mindfulness or the References of Mindfulness. And this comes from the Majjhima Nikaya number 10. So if you're not familiar with the suttas, there's about 3,000 suttas from the Buddhist time. And they put them in different baskets. That's called the Nikaya, right? So there's the Majjhima Nikaya is the middle length discourses. There's the short discourses and the longer discourses and the connected discourses and the numerical discourses. So there's all these ways of dividing it up. But there's quite a wealth of teachings from the time of the Buddha, at least as close as we can get to that. Now, the sutta, if you're going to read one sutta, this is probably a good one to read because it establishes, why do we practice mindfulness? How do we do it? And also, why do we do it? Now, you may have been exposed to different types of mindfulness. You know, maybe you did a Goenka method where you focus just on the breath and then you go through a scanning practice, or maybe you did Mahasi, where you learn how to note each breath, each experience, kind of that clarity. Or maybe there's Utejaniya, who has a different quality. Each of these types of meditation, even though they seem really different, have this common foundation, this common basis. Even traditions like Zen or Tibetan also have a foundation of mindfulness. And different teachers have emphasized different aspects of this sutta. Now, this sutta starts off kind of a little dramatically by saying this is the direct path to liberation. So he's not saying, okay, this is a nice thing to do. It's like, this is the direct way to practice, to get to liberation, to understand that, to see it for yourself. The Buddha said, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the attainment of the right method, for the realization of unbinding. In other words, the four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness. Now, this sutta is quite large. There's a lot of detail in it. There's a lot of practices. There's a lot of repetition that happens. So that's a lot to digest. I'm not going to give it to you all tonight. But just to give a quick overview, there's four foundations. And each of those foundations is kind of held by this overarching reason for practice, is toward liberation. And there's particular phrases which are repeated. So the four foundations, just in brief, we'll focus mostly just on body tonight, actually. But body is the first one. It's the largest in section with the most instruction. The second one is called Vedana. So Vedana is often translated as feeling tone, but don't be confused with feeling like emotions. It's really feeling as this feels pleasant, this feels unpleasant, or this is neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's this almost instantaneous flavoring that we attribute to some experience. Any of our senses can have that quality, right? We often overlook that because it happens so quickly. And what happens from once we feel it as pleasant or unpleasant, we move into liking or disliking. And that kind of builds from there. So catching at that early stage is a powerful foundation to focus on. The third foundation is that of mind states, right? And this is an interesting one. It's a very short one. And the Buddha is basically saying, just notice what your mind is. Notice the shape of your mind. Is your mind concentrated or is it more kind of spaced out? Is it happy or is it sad? He doesn't actually use those ones, but you can get my meaning. And what he's saying is just notice it without judging it. He doesn't ever say this kind of mind state is better than another one. He's calling us forth, calling us into this quality of mindfulness, which simply observes what's actually here without trying to change it or alter it. This is such a critical part of mindfulness. And this is one of the first things that we are confronted with when we learn to practice. Because we look at something, we sense something, and we automatically have a judgment around it. We're liking it, we're not liking it. We have an opinion about it. We start to think, oh, I'm doing this good. This was a nice meditation. Oh, that was a bad meditation. I was falling asleep, I was distracted. And yet mindfulness itself doesn't really care what your experience is. It just rests in the knowing of it and that awareness of it. And that actually provides the best possibility to learn from it, to be transformed by it. And the final foundation is that of the dharmas. All right. So if you like Buddhist lists, this is the one you can look at. There's the Four Noble Truths, there's the Five Hindrances, Five Aggregates, Six Sense Bases, and Seven Factors of Awakening. All right, so there's a lot in that last one. And basically, it's about learning to recognize when a hindrance is present, noticing the awakening factors so you can be present and aware of them and then work with them in a more skillful way. Right, so that's a quick overview. Let's dive into that first foundation of the body.
Wisdom
the body is such a... As Westerners, we have this interesting relationship to our bodies. And I think it's sometimes helpful to step back and, how do I relate to my body? Because we have all these messages of how the body should look, how it shouldn't look, and maybe we fit into that narrow frame or maybe we don't. You know, we have a lot of internal judgment about our bodies. We have maybe sometimes a lot of focus on hyperactivity or hyper excellence athletically. And yet how often are we just kind of disconnected from our bodies? Maybe disconnected or even disassociated, and we don't really land in what our body actually feels like. And so learning how to bring our minds and bodies back together to really connect deeply with that is so critical. You know, James Joyce's character, Mr. Duffy, there's a line where he says, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body, right? And sometimes that sums us up. You know, we were walking through space, through our lives, not even realizing how we got there. And learning how to simply connect with this breath, with this footstep, with this sensation can be very transformational. So throughout the sutta, there's these lines that just keep repeated over and over again. Now, if you recall, the suttas were originally transmitted orally. So people basically chanted them, right? So they would say, okay, this group, you're going to focus on the first foundation, this group on the second foundation and third foundation. Your job is to learn it, memorize it, and you keep chanting it and you teach the next generation. That's how it was for about 300 years, right? So you can imagine this chanting, the parts that were repeated, that really landed deeply because you'd hear it over and over and over again. And there'd be these new parts that would be added to it. And one of the refrains on this one is that the practitioner remains independent, unsustained by not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a person remains focused on the body in and of itself. And so it remains independent, unsustained by anything in the world. Now this phrase, independent and unsustained by, what does that mean? What is that pointing toward? What I think it points to, and this is the thread I want to weave in through this foundation, it's really pointing to understanding this nature of self, this separate sense of self. Because that self really arises in relationship to some experience. You know, someone honks their horn at you or says something obscene to you. You hear something or read something on the news. There is a charge that arises from that. The sense of you activates in relationship to that. That's being dependent and sustained by the world. Okay, that's triggering the world. And yet, what the Buddha discovered, and that people discovered yet to this day, is that that sense of self is an illusion. It's actually something that is arises and passes away, but it's not really what your essence is. When you see that and understand that in a deep way, that's becoming unsustained by life. By life isn't triggering that sense of self. And what instead is there's a deep sense of presence, is one way to say it, of non-separation. So this lens, I think, is a helpful one to look at with this first foundation, actually all the foundations. So that everything kind of boils down to this self-making. Now this foundation, there's six sections in it, right? So this is a very complete instructions. The first one is mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing. So cultivating this steady attention, this ongoing attention, sustained attention. What's actually here right now in this moment, breath by breath. And so first aspect is connecting with the breath itself, knowing when you're breathing out, well, notice when you're breathing out. Noticing if it's short or long. So these are very simplistic ways of instructing, but yet it's like it's asking us to see the entirety of the breath and also to not judge the breath or control the breath, right? So letting the breath do its own thing. Just notice if the breath is short, noticing if it's long, noticing if it's sustained or choppy. And this is already starting to disrupt this mechanism of self. Because one of the things the self loves to do is to control things. It likes to judge things, compare things. You know, that breath you just had now, was that a better breath than the breath before? You know, you may have not noticed it, but if you're meditating, you start to like, oh, that was a good breath. It was not such a good breath, right? And yet that activates that sense of self. That's making us feel sustained by, we're really taking birth, basically, in relationship to that breath. But the Buddha says, just notice the breath how it is. Get out of its way and just use it as a way to train your attention, to connect with moment by moment. A phrase from this section is, I will breathe in sensitive to the entire body. Sensitive to the entire body. And I love that quality of that sensitivity, that when your mindfulness starts to become more steady, more established, there's this exquisite sensitivity that starts to arise. The breath becomes something really magical to sense, to open to. And it's nice also to feel the breath as a whole body experience, not in a narrow part, but in a much broader experience. I will breathe in calming bodily fabrication. Right? So the reactivity, the sense of charge, we come in stressed, and we start to calm that. We also start to calm the reactivity and identification that this is my body. This is who and what I am. So this is the basis of the homework, is we can see how our body itself, we carry so much identification. We look in the mirror and we see all our reactions, our judgment, you know, how we should be or shouldn't be, the things we like and don't like. And it really locks into the sense of self. But if we tune into the actual sensations of the body, it's much harder to hold that sense of self, if we're really connected to that level. So remaining independent, unsustained by anything in the world. So the breath is the first section. Now the second section is the postures of the body. Okay, so first the Buddha says, okay, go sit quietly someplace in the woods by a tree in a hut and just feel your breath, sense your breath. Next one is trying to notice the posture of the body as it goes through. Now, if you've ever been on a meditation retreat, how many people have been on meditation retreats, by the way? All right, so that's a good chunk of you. So in the retreat format, it's actually really conducive to just trying to go into these foundations more fully, because you can feel you have nothing else to do but be present with yourself. So you can be aware of the body standing, sitting, laying down, going through all its activities. I'll just read this little section. So furthermore, when going forward and returning, they make themselves fully alert. When looking toward and looking away, when bending and extending their limbs, when carrying their outer cloak, their upper robe, their bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, remaining silent, we make ourselves fully alert. Right? So, and this is a part of meditation retreats, that you start to have this sustained quality, that everything you're doing becomes a meditation. So it's not sitting meditation or walking meditation. It's just everything that you're doing. And that comes from this foundation. In our daily life, it's a little harder to have that one-pointed focus. But yet we can keep just about 5 to 10% of our awareness on our bodies. And that can really add a lot of kind of ballast to help ground us into the present moment. Just try that tomorrow. When you're going through your day, whether you're working or at home or wherever you are, just keep a little awareness in your body. Can I feel my feet? Can I feel this breath? And see what happens, how that might transform your ability to be present, to be responsive to whatever life brings to you. So the next section is mindfulness with clear comprehension, right? So there's Vipassana, insight meditation, means to see clearly and to understand what's being seen. So this is this clear comprehension, to see with clarity, to perceive with understanding. So whether you're going forward or back, clear comprehension, looking straight or looking away. So basically all those last things he just talked about, all those different postures and activities, you're not only present and aware, but you also, there's a comprehension that this is what's happening. This is the intentionality that is driving that. This is the motivation that's driving that action. All right, so that all makes sense so far? All right, it gets a little bit more exciting here as we go along. So this is kind of just the mindfulness. Okay, that all makes sense. But the Buddha kind of turns up the heat around this quality of, why do you really understand this nature of self? Sometimes I think of this sutta as really learning to deconstruct the sense of self, to deconstruct the ways we identify around it, the way we claim I, me, and mine. Especially in the, with the body, we can really see this. And the first one is noticing the body as, what's actually it's called is the, what is it? The repulsive parts. The loathsome parts. So these are the parts that, it's a little harsh really from this day and age to look at your body and see, okay, see that you're trying to sense into where your phlegm is and when your liver is and your spleen, all these different organs. And what it's designed to do is to start to get us less attached to our bodies. As Westerners, I think we probably need to have a healthy way of attachment to our bodies first. There's a sutta, I forget where it was, but the Buddha instructed to do this kind of reflecting on the loathsome parts of the body, ugly parts of the body. He went away, taught somewhere else, came back, and there's a lot less of people around. And he asked, what happened? He said, well, people did what you said, and they got a little suicidal, and some of them died because of that, because they got so depressed by doing that. So I think he hopefully learned from that to back off a little bit. So I'm going to just glance over this part. Because I think we have enough sadness and depression already. A positive way of looking at this, though, is you can start to, as you do like maybe a body scan, you can say, okay, I'm going to open to where my lungs are, sense into what the lungs feel like, or sense to where the liver is or the stomach, kind of sense into the kidneys. Right? So it's kind of directing the attention in more and more finite ways. Another maybe more benign way he talked about this is if you had a sack of grains with all the different, I forget the grains he talked about. Let's say you have millet and quinoa and you have some chickpeas in there and some navy beans and some black beans. All those different beans, you know, combined they look like, you know, they think, okay, that's all what you are. But you start to look at them piece by piece, the whole starts to dissolve. Right? It's not like it... like you kind of fall into a puddle on the ground or something, but you just, that sense of identification starts to fall away. The next element, you know, so part of this is the five aggregates, but we don't want to get you overwhelmed with lists this tonight. The next reflection is on the material elements, right? So this is even a further deconstruction of that sense of me. So this is, again, kind of an older way of looking at the body, but basically there's the fire element, there's the earth element, the air element, and the water element. And that was one way that, even today, some technologies use that to describe the body, some different types of medicine and things like that. But yet if we look at the body from that element, elemental theory, you start to see your body in a very different way. What's the earth element? What's the hard element? Can I feel my bones touching the ground? Can I feel that solidity? Can I feel the sense of movement through the water element? Can I feel the space through the air element? Can I feel the heat moving through my body? If I start to relate to my body from those elements, we become less identified, less attached to ourselves as a body. It's more of this fluidity that starts to go through. So up to this point, we've really gone into this kind of gradual deconstruction of this identification with body as me, right? So seeing the parts of the body, seeing how this is this part and that part, start to see all of those in a way that I become less, you know, intact, if that makes sense. Because we tend to think of ourselves as this whole self of me. But I look at the different aspects of myself, we can see how it's actually much more fluid than we ever thought ourselves to be. And the final one, the last one, is called the nine cemetery contemplations. All right. The nine cemetery contemplations. All right. So at that time in India where the Buddha was, you know, death and dying and dead bodies weren't something that gets shunted away. Like in our society, it's really hard to actually see a dead body, right? Unless you're in medicine or you, you know, maybe you're an emergency worker or a hospital worker, you don't often see dead people, right? Not, you don't get a chance to see that. And yet, that also kind of robs us from that sense of reality that this body too will die. You know, that everyone I love will die, right? And that's a, I think that's a disservice a bit to us. You know, some cultures, some traditions, you know, there's a tradition of caring for the body after it's dead. So there's a sense of sinning with the body. One of my neighbors, the father died in the house. And they were some type of Buddhist, but they had priests come over and they chanted there for like 7 days. And there's chickens and sacrificial chickens, all this stuff going on. But there's a lot of emphasis around this transition as we go through that. And so often, like when someone passes away, we bring them forth. We call their name, like we did with Kristen, who passed away on Halloween, to just remember them. Right? But we don't actually often see someone who's decaying. And this is a chance for you to contemplate when you're out walking and you see a roadkill or see an animal that's dead, to reflect that that too is of your nature. That creature was alive and had its own way of navigating the world and no longer does. Throughout this one, the Buddha said that just reflect that also my own body is this of the same nature, such it was will become and will not escape from it. All right, so this is kind of an intense one that the Buddha talks about first looking at a dead body. So you can, in that time in India, you could go to the charnel grounds, and that was a common reflection for monks and nuns to go there and reflect on death because it brings quite a bit of urgency to your practice. So you see a body that's just recently dead and then starting to decompose and seeing how that nature goes. And this sutta basically takes this deconstruction more and more from the decaying to the body being kind of spread by scavengers to, you know, just a skeleton, to finally a skeleton without any flesh or blood, to finally the bones whitened, starting to become, you know, bleached by the sun, finally piled up more than a year old, and then finally decomposed into powder. And this applies to this body too. Such is its nature, such is its future, such is its unavoidable fate. Right? So this is some heavy medicine that the Buddha has just dropped on us, right? So we go through this process of feeling the breath, feeling it just as a movement through the body, and then we start to become less attached to our control of it. We start to see we can be aware without having to be control in what's being seen. Then we start to notice this body, you know, okay, I can actually notice the body outside of my identification of it, noticing the sensations, and I can start to release those identifications around it. And finally, this sense of this body is mine, even when I die, that itself starts to be taken away from us. So this sutta is a very powerful one. You know, some of it may be familiar, some of it's not so much. But the purpose of wise mindfulness is to be able to see the nature of this body, to see it in a very clear way. First establish the capacity to be mindful, but not only stay there, but to start to see how the body holds so much of our identification. And yet we can be free of that. Not in a way that's disassociated, not in a way that's disconnected, but we just don't take it so personally. Right? We care for the body. We do what needs to be done with it. But we also start to hold it in a more light way. And that starts to point toward this freedom that the Buddha discovered outside of this sense of self. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle. And as we sit together, let's get a sense of this body. Letting the breath just move how it will. Not having to change it or alter it. Giving it space to be just how it is. sense into the different parts of the body, your hands, your feet, your legs, arms, face. If you had never experienced a mirror, had a photograph of yourself, how would you relate to this body? Open to the coming and going of sensations. All right, I wanted to say a few words about the homework before we open any questions you might have. So the homework, I put it in the chat for those online, and so hopefully it's there. Maybe Kathy or Tamara could repost it so it's fresh. So reflect on how you identify as your body. Right? So just that sense, you can look at yourself in the mirror, you can look at how your clothes fit, you know, whatever your pride, shame, whatever you might be feeling about the body. And just kind of acknowledge that, acknowledge how that conditioning has come through. Because each one of us, you know, we're part of our society. Your society says, this is how a body should look, how it shouldn't look. And we spend so much suffering trying to fit ourselves into that narrow frame. And you can start to do it more specifically. Look at a part of your body like your hand or your foot, parts that I like about, parts I dislike. And then close your eyes and sense into that part of the body. And notice what happens when you connect at the level of sensation. How the level of idea starts to fall away. It's not maintained unless you think about it. You have to add energy into that. But if you relax the energy of the thinking and you're just connecting directly with the sensations, the outline of the body or that part of the hand may fall away, the outline of the foot might fall away. And there's a level of freedom in that. It's not so defined, it's hard to label, but yet it's very alive, very present. And if you're not your body, what are you? Where are you located? So finally, I would suggest you look up the Satipatthana Sutta. If you haven't read it, or if you have, it's good to review it. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 10. You can just do MN10, and that will take you there. Access to Insight is a nice online source. All right, so are there any questions in the room? You can raise your physical hand online. You can raise your virtual hand and see if we can help clarify the talk a little bit.
Oh, hello. Trying to remember what I was going to ask.
Here, come to you. Take your time.
So the definition of mindfulness that you gave prior to your talk or at the beginning, and the meditation that we just did, implied that mindfulness was about noticing sensations as they arise, or at least that's a component of it, right?
Yes, mindfulness can focus on many things. Sensation is one aspect.
Yeah, some phenomenological thing that comes up.
Yes.
So that didn't seem to match items 3 through 6 on, or 4 through 6 on your list.
Hmm.
That seemed more like remembering or invoking that these are truths.
Right. Yeah.
Is there a sensation or phenomena that those things map onto. So to clarify, like the nine cemetery, the sixth one, I forget what that list is called.
Yes, the nine cemetery contemplations.
Yeah. Is that something that, yeah, so I guess my question is that more of a remembering thing, something that's intentionally invoked, or is it a sensation that can be like a phenomenon that can be observed simply like tapping into your breath?
Well, it can be both. Right. So basically the contemplations. So mindfulness, we often talk about it in terms of this bare attention without adding much thought to it or any thought to it. Like thought seems to be something that gets in its way. But yet thought itself, when it's used well, can help us deepen understandings around. That's why some of the other ones, too, when he talks about, you know, going through the different parts of the body and kind of feeling your liver or your spleen or those kind of aspects. Looking outside at the body decaying and reflecting how this is too is yours, you're holding your attention on it, and then you're contemplating, kind of connecting it more clearly with yourself. So yeah, it's mindfulness. Probably more, I think your question is perhaps more around how we present mindfulness kind of separate from the investigative side of things, or maybe the contemplation side of it, but really they can blend together. Does that make sense? Not quite.
It does. It just makes me wonder if there's a better word than mindfulness that could be used.
Probably. Yeah, there probably is. You might. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just saying that wraps around both of those things.
I might tend to maybe use like investigation as another word for it, mindfulness and investigation together. So here's another way I think of it, and this is an important piece for us as meditation students, is that we spend a lot of time focusing on the breath, but sometimes we think that that's all it is, that mindfulness is only the breath meditation. But it's really, you know, we focus on different parts of experience, but also different kind of substance of that experience, if that makes sense, like the hindrances. You know, when you notice that you're being sleepy, stepping back and noticing, oh, this is the hindrance of sleepiness, of sloth and torpor, I should say, that's really helpful. You can do the same thing with the five aggregates. When you notice, okay, there's form activating, there's a sense of vedana coming, pleasant or unpleasant. So basically, you can use mindfulness and pop anything into it. So sensations of the body, see all the six senses. But remember, the sixth sense is also cognitive, so we can actually focus on how those things are arising in our body. That's really helpful to be able to notice that as an experience.
So, for example, I see some unfortunate bit of roadkill on the road.
Yes.
And that triggers, thoughts about impermanence and actually maybe noticing some impermanence as it, you know,
yes,
as things come and go.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You see some roadkill and you just notice what it elicits.
Yeah.
And so you're noticing all the emotional content, the mental content that's arising. Okay, maybe there's disgust, maybe there's horror, maybe there's sadness. And then, okay, this creature was alive and is no longer alive. And that's also my fate. You know, so that's where it connects. So it's basically this bigger capacity just to be aware and be present. And you can be going through life. You could be having this conversation like we're having right now and be aware of that too.
I have more questions, but I won't take it. I won't monopolize the conversation. So.
All right. If we have time, we can come back to you. We'll see how chatty the group is. Okay, Gary, go ahead. Online. Let's see. I got to give you permission to unmute.
Hi, I'm curious as to why this teaching is not higher in the list of teachings. Why it's not higher in the, I guess I'd call it priority of teachings. Could you speculate on that?
Sure. And it's kind of different than the way that we teach it in the West, because usually we don't start with wise view or wise intention or wise action. We start with wise mindfulness. And I think it may be just the way the Western mind is, maybe part of the question where it comes from is that we are so heady. We are very, you know, we are in our minds a lot. Okay, let's kind of connect with direct experience. Learn how to actually make contact. So maybe I think that's a good adaptation for the Western mind. But in terms of maybe the Buddhist time, you know, he would often start with, you know, basically trying to convince people that, okay, the way they're practicing or living their lives is causing more suffering. You know, understanding there's, if you look at the wise view section of it, so wise view, we think of it as Four Noble Truths. But it's understanding, okay, what's really causing suffering? What's causing freedom? And start to discern that. And then wise intention helps connect that. And probably the Buddha felt that, my guess is he felt that if someone's living a really unethical life, meditating is not going to really help them. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to have enough, you know, non-harm in their life. They have to have enough kind of goodwill for their minds to settle down. Right. And so it does kind of make sense from that way. I also tend to think of the Eightfold Path not as a linear progression, but more of this almost intertwined rope.
Yeah.
That they're all kind of operating all together. And again, this sutta, I hope I can talk about it the last week of the month. It's the Great 40, and the Buddha talks about these three aspects of wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness basically run circles around all the other ones. They basically make them all possible. So, yeah, it does seem kind of backward, but I can imagine that's probably why it was.
Thanks.
You're welcome. All right. Okay, let's, I don't know which was first. Okay, we'll go with you and then with you.
So we talk about paying attention to the breath, or paying attention to our feet on the floor, or scanning our bodies, or paying attention to sounds that are far away, or sounds that are in the room.
Yes.
And I find that when I meditate, I'll bounce back and forth between those. And I wonder, does it matter what we're paying attention to? Does it make any difference?
Yes and no. Do you want more than that?
I'd like more than that, please.
I'm teasing you. So in one way, it doesn't matter. It does not matter at all. You know, as long as we're really training mindfulness, training our minds to be present and to see clearly, understand clearly, right? And also see what reactions arise from that, like with the first question. So if a reaction arises from this ambulance going by, you know, I can be mindful of that experience. So in that way, it doesn't matter. You know, and that's this tradition at Seattle Insight is a little bit more aligned with like the Thai forest tradition of how we be mindful. It's much more of a kind of a natural mindfulness. It's not so like laser focused. It's more just being aware of things, right? And there's a natural way that cultivates and unfolds. Now, I'll make an argument why it does matter. Like if I want to really develop some steadiness of attention, I want to develop concentration, then I'm going to kind of isolate my senses to just this one thing, letting go of everything else, right? So that builds that quality of concentration, that one-pointedness. Other thing it does is sometimes it's really helpful to be able to focus on one thing to understand it more fully, more deeply, right? So some of these are kind of the slippery ways that we cause suffering for ourselves or patterns. Like sometimes I want to really understand what's the nature of this suffering right here, right now, and be able to focus just on that so I can actually see through the confusion and the delusion to understand it more fully is very helpful. So basically what I suggest is just be clear what you're doing, right? Because another detriment to kind of switching all over the place is sometimes that's driven by restlessness. Okay, this is kind of boring in here. There's nothing happening. Okay, then I'm going to go listen outside. Okay, that's too much. That's too loud. I'm going to come back. So if it's being driven by reactivity or disliking or wanting, that's kind of also be an issue too. So kind of that's the thing, is be clear about why am I switching it? Am I just open to what's ever arising? Okay, that's great. But if I'm choosing to, if I'm even unconsciously choosing because it's uncomfortable or I want something more pleasant, then that's kind of, that's a little bit of a problem.
I'm just going to concentrate on one thing. Yeah. Then that choice comes before the beginning of the meditation, say.
Yes.
What's the difference? I choose my breath. I choose my feet on the floor. I choose my scanning.
So the difference, well, there, in that way, there's not much of a difference if I just choose to focus on one area, assuming that area is kind of equally uncharged. Right? Let's say you have an unresolved history of trauma and you focus on your breath. And as you feel your breath, you feel that trauma response starting to arise. Okay, so that's not such a helpful object of attention. Maybe the feet will be much more comfortable in that place. Maybe I have COPD or I'm recovering from COVID or I have something going on. It's hard to breathe. Each breath kind of triggers things. So it's basically, if you can connect with it and it's not really triggering, then yeah, it doesn't matter so much. But maybe I want to develop a sense of embodiment, of feeling my feet. I mean, we could say, okay, I could ask half the room to focus just on your feet, the other half just to focus on your breath, and then come back next week and compare notes. There'll probably be different cultivations that will come from that. Mm-hmm. You know, some people, the breath would be much, you know, maybe, I don't know, who knows what it will be, but, you know, there's different causes and effect. But from a mindfulness perspective, it doesn't matter that much. A specific question, I might change my answer completely, right? Right? If you said, this area is really hard to feel, this is really charged to feel, this area holds grief, then there'd be a choice about whether to focus on that or not. Right? I don't know if that's, I'm being very, and I'm trying to be cagey, but it's basically, it depends.
Okay.
Is there anything else around that? I don't know if I'm quite getting to your heart of your question.
Well, I'm trying to make a choice myself. And so I'm like, what do I choose? So
focus on your breath and your belly.
Yeah.
That'd be my go-to.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. Yes.
I've held this question for a long time, but it's really come up with today's talk. I'm really aware of how we're reading these things from our point of view post Descartes and our idea of mind and body being separate from one another.
Right, yeah.
And I'm curious, from your understanding of the Dharma, how is that filter that we're using a mistaken way of reading some of these six points, for example, or the idea of what mind is, even when we're talking about mindfulness? Mm. I know it's a big topic, so I...
No, but it's
but I've been holding on to it for a long time. What's that?
Could you fix Descartes?
Yeah, let's fix Descartes.
So, you know, Descartes walked into a bar. And how's the joke go? There's a funny joke, but I see. I'll try to think of it. But the point, yeah, your point, you make a very good point, is that the way we read the suttas is really filtered, right? And even more so the translation, you know, we were reading a translation from a person with their own filter. You know, when I was going through my teacher training, we were studying the sutta quite a bit. At one point I had about, I don't know, like 9 different translations of this one sutta. And it's really different. Like if you go online, look up some different translations and they use different words, and some of the words, you know, fit, and sometimes they don't fit you based on your experience. But this is what I would say, is that this is kind of, the suttas are kind of a, it's like a map, but you have to actually follow the territory yourself. And when you walk that territory yourself, that the things you see, the things you discover about that territory, the inner territory of experience, of understanding, that transforms how you interpret the map. So that when I first read this sutta, I had a very different understanding than I do now, right? If that makes sense. So let's say there's something, like I could read this sutta in a very different way than I did tonight, because I tend to orient around non-self a lot with my teaching and my own lens of practice. I tend to see it from that perspective. And I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it from that perspective. But to me, that kind of pops out based on that. So there's lots of ways we can interpret it. And yeah, there's centuries of conditioning, you know, of assumption, of separation, of body and mind. And so it's almost like you have to listen with that real freshness of it, you know, and be willing to hear. Don't get too opinionated about, this is what the sutta says, this is how it should be. More hold it as an ongoing, you're just a vague map. But once you see that for yourself, then it starts to become alive. Does that help a little bit? Yeah. Yes, Ryan?
So the cart walks into a bar. And he has a drink and he's getting up to leave, and the bartender says, "Do you want another one?" And Descartes says, "No, I think not." And poof, he disappears.
That's the one. There you go, "I think not." Okay. All right, anyone else have anything to add? Either Descartes chokes or... Go ahead, Nate.
Yep, I have maybe a silly question, but how does one feel their spleen or liver? I don't know, I just feel like a vague sensations in my abdomen, but I actually couldn't tell you where my spleen is, for example. But I hear like this, like sensing of organs.
Yeah.
Like I've heard this multiple times before, and it seems like an ability some people have. I don't know.
Yeah, it starts to get into this realm of, you know, how much literally we take it to be true versus just learning to focus on a particular part of the body and sensing into it. So we're kind of putting an idea around it, an anatomical idea around it, and trying to, you know, sense into that area. And, you know, certainly, you know, if you look at, you know, the 3,000-year-old history of acupuncture, I mean, the practitioners who developed that, they were very sensitive to how these different organs related to each other. You know, they have a little different model than the Western model, but it's not less valid. It's just that deep understanding of that. And so what I would suggest is, you know, if you're interested in that, you know, get an anatomy book and say, okay, spleen is over here. Here's the liver, kidneys are back here, and one's higher, one's lower. And just kind of sense into that part of the body and just let that kind of be a process of trying to, you know, picture it or understand it. But also don't be too, you know, "Oh, that feels like there's a rock there." Is that, you know, we can make a whole story about it, right? It's more like that sense of focusing. And the power of the mind and mindfulness, I think there's a lot of undevelopedness that it can happen. We can really develop a lot of clarity of seeing, but again, it's, you know, is it just that practice of focusing on a part of the body? Yeah. The main thing is to see that we're not the sum. How is it like we're the sum of, not the sum of our parts, that we start to see these different parts. And this is something the Buddha would often talk about around non-self, is, You know, if you look at like a, I do a less gruesome version of it. If you took a car and you took apart all the parts and laid them all out, is that still a car? You know, but we sum it together. And the same thing with that sense of the, you know, the perception or the sense going through the aggregates. There's form, the physical form. There's the Vedana, the feeling tone. There's the consciousness. There's the sankharas. There's perception. We put all that together. Oh, that's me. We start to separate it out. It's like, okay, well, maybe that's not me. And those can be nice ways to focus in. Like we had that first question, second question around where do you focus your attention? You can focus really, what is the sense of sankharas? What's the sense of Vedana? That becomes what my mindfulness is. Instead of being focusing on the breath, focusing on that aspect. Does that help at all, Nate?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome. I could change the homework. Tell me about how your spleen was next week. All right, Gary, go ahead. You want to have a follow-up?
No, it's a little bit, actually it's quite a bit different.
Okay.
I've been doing a lot of reading on near-death experiences, NDE. And one consistent theme through those who have experienced near-death experiences and what they report when they come back from that, when they actually did not die, the conclusions have been very interesting from the point of view of the science that has been put to these experiences. And one is that the mind is actually is the universal consciousness. That's what I'm looking for.
Mm.
And it's not dependent, that is it, meaning consciousness, is not dependent on the brain, because in near-death experiences, the brain has ceased to function. And so the theory is developing, or the outlook, the hypothesis is developing, that the brain is receiving, or is a device, for lack of a better term, that we humans use, to receive information from the mind.
Mm.
And so the mind becomes central to our understanding of and our experiencing of consciousness. And this seems to be very consistent with the practice of mindfulness as well. Actually, there's a professor at the University of Oregon who's a deep, I call her a long-term meditator, and she has seen the connection as well in her meditation practice. So I was wanting to know if you had comments or thought, what your thoughts and comments were on this.
Yeah, I think they're onto something. I think they're discovering from a different angle, you know, what we're trying to do as meditators is what, you know, the Four Noble Truths is really freeing up that central location of consciousness. Because usually we do think it's the mind or it's different parts of the, you know, the brain or history. But it's like, it sounds like what they're discovering is it's actually much, much broader than that. And, you know, you can also think of when people have like an organ transplant, sometimes they experience things very differently. It's like, you know, maybe they start to like asparagus and they hated asparagus, or something, you know, something more of our personality changes. So there's parts of our, you know, consciousness gets kind of spread out throughout the whole body. So I think that's right aligned with that.
That what you're mentioning is also a consistent experience of those who experience near-death experiences. That they come back from that very changed. Their personalities change. Their outlook about life changes.
Yeah. Yeah, that sense of seeing is more of an essence, seeing a glimpse into what you really are, and there's that much broader perspective. There's a loosening of that identification. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So
thanks.
Meditation, near death experience, which pick. So sometimes it's probably a little more controllable with the meditation side of things, because you never know when the near death might go a little bit beyond that, that point. So thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing that, Gary. Yeah, it's, there's much more to us than we realize. All right, anyone else? Okay, well, that was one of the wild, more wild question sections we've had, which is great. It's nice to have a lightness around it all. All right, so next week I'll offer kind of a shorter version of this talk, maybe slightly different angle, just more, hopefully more clear. And then we'll have a 20-minute section for you to talk about yourself, talk about your own practice, particularly around this homework, around what have you learned about your body. Take that as a question, the question of what our assumptions are that Sherry had as we lead into our practice. Try to drop those assumptions and see what actually is here. So maybe start with that assumption, okay, this is what my body is, this is where I am, and then actually use mindfulness to look, to see clearly, is this really true? Am I really as identify with this body as I think I am? All right. So I look forward to hearing from you next week, and thank you all.